I have this memory of you, Julian, and this long-haired youth in Merrily We Roll Along at Dunlop.
Like a young Bon Jovi.
it's an image that stayed with me. And, I mean, how early was that in your... in the scheme of things?
That show? Yeah. That was the second show I did. Second show. Yeah, I auditioned for it 10 times. Michael Grandage, the taskmaster, the enforcer, the punisher. He put me through my paces. I remember being in a kind of desperately wanting that role for many reasons, I think. I wanted to work at the Don Mar. I wanted to work with him. I was very ambitious. I wanted to kind of show the world, you know, in that kind of youthful sort of way, show the world what I could do, what I thought I could do, in a very sort of naive way.
And that's what the piece is about.
It is actually, yeah. And I look back and think, oh my God, it was terrible. And I think I've sort of changed so much, really. It's quite frightening to look back. And weirdly enough, you know, that we don't know whether you were aware of it or you came to it, but you know, when we did the concert 2 years ago, the 10-year anniversary.
I certainly did. It was electrifying.
It was a sort of an extraordinary opportunity you never have in this business to look back, especially with that piece.
Yeah.
To look back not over a role again, but particularly over one's life again, because it's about looking back on your life and seeing the trajectory and your successes and your failures, your regrets, your you know, your faults.
But you see, I thought what was so lovely about it was, you know, it needs people that are fresh and eager and forming their talents in some way.
I think it does. I think it does need that. Otherwise, there's no heartbreak. If it's old people, if it's older actors, if it's mid 30s or above, personally, I think if they're acting young, then I don't think you get the sense of heartbreak. Mm. You know, mm. I might be wrong, but I think that production, even though it's quite frustrating that it couldn't go anywhere else, because everyone wanted to take it, but legally we couldn't do it, it seemed to touch so many people. And still to this day, 12 years, 13 years on, people, you know, talk about it, and it seemed to have affected, not necessarily, you know, my performance, I don't mean in an arrogant way, but in terms of just the story and the way that it was directed and the way the story was told.
Yes.
It seemed to have such a resonance, you know, for people.
It's a wonderful piece, and I just don't understand why it didn't work on its first outing. And I actually once asked Hal Prince, I had an interview with him, and why didn't it work? And he said, I think it was because I lost my nerve. And the way I wanted to do it, very, very simply, kind of, I just lost my nerve and I should have stuck to that.
Well, also, it's more of an English show than it is an American show. Sondheim works, you know, weirdly better in England, because it's about heartbreak, it's about resentment, it's about jealousy, it's about all these things that, you know, in Europe we love to depict. We love the melancholy, we love the depression, we love the angst. Yeah. In America, especially in musical theatre, it's all about heart on sleeve, it's about optimism, it's about we can conquer the world. And I think that sometimes, even though obviously there are major exceptions and a lot of great revivals have happened, you know, in the last 30 years in America very successfully.
Yeah.
But generally in the genesis of the piece, you know, they haven't been commercially successful. Mm. And I can understand that.
You've sorted yourself out rather better than Franklin Shepherd, I think, well, in terms of career and personal life. But
I'm trying.
I'm fascinated by your voice, Julian, because you were a choral scholar, weren't you? Big time. I mean, real big time.
I started as a chorister when I was a kid, you know, and that was pretty hardcore in terms of the musical training. It was 3 hours a day, plus, you know, working on your instruments. And I played at that stage, I played the piano, which I still do, but... And also, you have to have another instrument as well, so I learned the trumpet and then I also learned the organ. And, you know, it's 5 years of hardcore musical training. And it set me up, you know, to be able to have a career in music. you know, a lot of musicians, a lot of professional musicians, a lot of opera singers and composers had that type of education. A choral education is something that is, rather than being an instrumentalist, I think it sort of engenders a sense of fun. Music making with other people, the sort of collaborative element, I think is something that it's very inspiring. And it's not about locking yourself away, you know, for 5 hours and practicing, you know, Schumann's piano concerto and sort of, you know, kind of searching your soul. I think that I what I love about what I do and what I think where it stems from is that feeling of being together, of singing together.
Yeah, yeah.
And especially in a, you know,
communal music.
It really is. You know, taking being an actor and being the whole ego side and your career and ambition aside, the idea of the feeling I got from singing in, you know, this amazing building, St. Paul's Cathedral, where the acoustic alone, and you sang with this extraordinary organ, and you know, it's a big choir, 30 kids and 18 professional singers singing the other parts. I mean, it's thrilling.
Yeah,
it's you know, touring and recording and, you know, being a professional musician.
Your voice, I mean, I suppose most show baritones are quite high, but you've got this fantastic reach at the top of your voice. I mean, you're almost a tenor.
I'd say I was a tenor. I mean, you know,
you call yourself a tenor?
I think so. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's difficult in musical theatre to. I mean, I don't classify myself as a musical theatre performer or even a musical theatre singer. I class myself as an actor and a singer.
Yeah.
I don't really get het up with, you know, obviously in the opera world you have to be more specific about, you know, I'm a lyric tenor or heroic tenor or I'm a, you know, light baritone or I'm a bass baritone.
Yeah.
The lower part of my voice has never been particularly full. I was certainly a tenor when I was singing in choirs. I have, you know, where it needs, I have, you know, top C's and D's. But I wouldn't. You know, in music, in this kind of music, you don't need. Thankfully, you don't really need that. But you know, I can't. You know, underneath the stage, I'm useless. But I can still just about do, you know, the soliloquy and stuff like that.
Listening to you doing Billy Bigelow, the soliloquy,
I mean,
the ending of that scares the shit out of most performers because it is quite high, and the rest of the piece is kind of centred in the middle.
The beginning scares the shit out of me, to be honest with you. I mean, that's, you know, having just recorded it
with John. We were talking about it.
Oh, really? Yeah. I mean, you know, it's like, it's not something that... You know, I feel comfortable from about E upwards. Anything below that, and I feel like I'm trying not to dig it out, but I don't have that. I don't have like the John Raitt kind of. I mean, he had an extraordinary.
Amazing,
he was amazing because he had the top.
Yeah.
Like no one else.
Yeah.
But he also had the low stuff, and that's the voice in him. You know.
I'm glad you mentioned him because he often gets overlooked because of Gordon McRae in the movie. And that stage recording is special.
I mean, you know, that recording he does on TV where he's showing off ridiculous and he's standing, you know, in his turtleneck jumper and he's really giving it the full, and then he does the ridiculous top B flat at the end, which is just basically showing off. But it's amazing.
Yeah.
But he doesn't have that honeyed slightly. I mean, Gordon McRae's, it's spine tingling, his voice.
Because it's conversational, I suppose, it can be set low, and I mean, there's such an amazing set piece, that soliloquy. I mean, whole musicals are based on less material,
of course,
than they contain.
Yeah.
So, let's talk about Finding Neverland. Before the musical was thought of, had you seen the movie and registered it?
I have seen the movie.
And what were your feelings? Because it's a very touching...
It moved me very much. I mean, I didn't really know a huge amount about Jane Barry. I've seen Peter Pan, the story, and knew the actors involved. But I thought it was a very... I thought it was a very affecting film.
We have all of those involved in this afternoon's Pirate Side flying rehearsal to the stage, please. All involved in some...
Flying rehearsal? You know we're in a working theatre, don't you?
I think that... It, you know, the imaginative way it was directed appealed to me. The idea that, the theatrical side also appealed to me, and the family side. I think that it works as a film on lots of different levels, and I think that's an extraordinary. I mean, Freddie Highmore, who happens to be my agent's son, I think gives an extraordinary performance. Extraordinary. I think it's a good sort of old fashioned film.
Yes.
You know, in the true good sense. So when it landed on my desk, I thought, oh God, it's going to be, you know, sentimental, treacly, whimsical. And I read the book first. Because often when you get, you know, for musicals, you get sent demos.
Yeah.
And I try and avoid that at all costs.
Because the book is the thing.
Well, the book is the thing also. I don't want to hear, I want to see the score.
Yeah.
I want to see what the music is really before I hear it. I like to play it on the piano. Because the first impression is so important to me, and if I hear someone singing it in a certain way, I think, with a synthesizer and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'm struck by the depth of the book, and I was amazed by the music. I think, it's rare for music to be written like this nowadays.
Mm.
It's a proper musical, and it's, you know, and it's an extraordinary part, extraordinary journey that this guy goes on.
I would imagine that one of the difficulties of making a musical version of Finding Neverland is keeping that balance between the fantasy stuff, the stuff that, you know, is unlocked in J.M. Barrie when he meets this family,
sure.
And the very personal relationship that he has with this woman.
Yeah.
So by the sound of it, they've cracked that.
I think we're on our way. I think there's work to be done. Right. You know, that's the point of doing this, you know, and I think we're not doing a biopic. Certainly in this country, we know that J.M. Barrie, it's not a true to life. I had no idea, you know, what went on.
Yeah.
But we're not trying to do some kind of documentary. We're trying to do something that is a piece of theatre, and the focus of it is a man's imagination, an imagination that turns from somewhere that's sterile to somewhere that's able to create a piece of literature that has, you know, that's still inspiring, you know, offshoots all the time. Think of Starcatcher on Broadway last year. Think of this play that Mike Grand is about to do with Judi Dench. Peter Pan is played, you know, in up and down the country every year, you know.
Yeah.
God knows how many times. It is something that he unlocked and touched, thank you.
Yeah.
That is the interesting part, and that's what we're trying to explore and focus on.
Are you, presumably you are, because you're a working actor, and actors love to explore, and they're inquisitive, or good actors are. When they say musicals aren't written but rewritten, I mean, this period, has there been a lot of rewriting work? And are you
we
happy
writing
to do that?
4:30 on Tuesday before the opening night, we were rewriting.
Amazing.
I don't know who said it. Was it Fritz Lowe, or was it...
Mm-hmm.
Richard Rodgers, or one of the guys, you know, they're like, never stop rewriting. You just rewrite, even when the show's 3,000 shows in, you're always tinkering. Look at Sondheim now, he's still tinkering at things, still
yes.
tinkering at his shows.
Roadshow.
Yeah, you know, it's like, it's such a collaborative thing that you are always trying to sharpen and focus, especially a show like this, because it works on different levels, to different audiences, in fact, to kids, because it has become a family show, rightly so, because it is about family. But a show that can work for a 10-year-old and that can work for a 70-year-old or a 50-year-old, you know, sophisticated 45-year-old or whatever,
yeah.
It's quite a difficult balance. And I think that we're trying not to please everyone, because I think that's a mistake, but there is such richness to the material, is trying to find the right balance,
yes,
for it, and that's, you know, what we're still trying to do.
You're whetting my appetite. I'm seeing it in about an hour. What was the musical you were doing on off Broadway when you were stricken?
I pulled a muscle in my neck, which was a disaster, really. It's a spasm. It wasn't anything to do with my vocal cords because I was singing totally fine.
Ladies and gentlemen, Neverland Company, for your information, today's warm-up will be on stage.
But I had a tiny little muscle in my neck which locked up. I don't know exactly how it happened. I think it was something physical that I did. And it meant that I couldn't turn my couldn't tilt my larynx, very specifically.
Oh, Jesus.
So I could sing up to about a D, and then everything else I couldn't turn it. And I went to like seven or eight different people in New York to try and fix it. And it was just a case of, you know, time, really, and letting it release, like you slip a disc, or you have a muscle in spasm, it wouldn't respond to any treatment immediately.
Oh, that must have been agonising, though, particularly when you're in the middle of doing something.
Well, I'd done
45
previews of the show, and I'd done the press, and 2 days before opening, you know, we're ready to celebrate and ready to open it properly.
What was the piece again?
It's called Death Takes a Holiday. It was written by Maury Esten, who wrote Nine and
indeed.
Titanic and
indeed.
The rest of it.
Yeah.
And
the other Phantom of the Opera.
And the other Phantom of the Opera, indeed. It was an interesting piece, really interesting piece. It was a great part, and it was heartbreaking.
Agonizing.
What?
I just want to tell you that I know you worked quite a bit with John Wilson, who's an old mate of mine, and I think what he's doing is extraordinary with that band and those. I just want to tell you, though, that that duet, the West Side Story balcony scene in the last prom Broadway show was... I think that's about as close as it gets to being... I thought it was perfect. You and Sierra. Just marvellous. And, of course, as Sod's Law would have it, because of all the rights issues, it didn't end up on the TV.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure...
John was
livid. Sure, yeah, there were... You know, I felt we were looking for an item in the second half. I mean, I said I couldn't do more than three numbers because I was rehearsing this. And this is the hardest thing I've ever done. I mean, I'm on stage. It's like doing The Producer or something. I'm on stage for 2.5 hours. I don't stop. It's different energy. It's like, it's emotionally draining as well as physically tough. And I felt that I couldn't do more than three numbers. And we were looking for a number in the second half. He said, do you want to do a solo or do you want to duet? And we just kept going through loads and loads and loads and loads and loads of different things. And I was going to do like Tony Newley, and then it was going to be, you know, all sorts of, you know, go back to Jerome Kern, or, you know, we had lots of ideas.
Mm.
But in the end, he thought, well, because he'd just done West Side Story up at the stage. And he thought, what about that? And I thought, you know, with Sierra, who's, you know, on the money.
Isn't she just?
Yeah. I thought, yeah, why not? But then, of course, we ran into problems because they wouldn't let us do it at the start. Then they wouldn't let us do it with dialogue. It's like, well, there's no point doing without dialogue because we're just going to be standing there waiting for the music, waiting to sing.
And the fact is, you're both actors, and what worked and what reminded you of what a masterpiece that is because of the seamlessness of the way the song works around the dialogue, the scene works.
It's really beautiful. I mean, it moves me so much. And I mean, I remember seeing, you know, the very famous, you know, making of with Yosa Carreras and Kirita Kanawa, which is, for a lot of people, is the only, because there are not many productions of West Side Story put on, because it's so difficult.
Yeah.
I don't know whether there's actually been a definitive, one we call a definitive production.
Glad to hear you say that, because that is it, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's because it is so difficult.
It's so hard to cast. And it needs an orchestra, a proper orchestra, not just some tin pot 15 piece in a band.
Absolutely.
It needs a proper 60 piece.
Absolutely.
And also because it needs kids, and it's really hard to find kids to do that kind of, because it's heavy duty singing. And you know, I felt, you know, slightly like I was 20 years too old to do it.
You suspended our discipline.
But to sing that kind of, to sing that music in that atmosphere and that orchestra.
Yeah, it was special.
It was just magical.
You've done your first album, Decca.
Yep.
Which there's one track that I simply adore, and that's the Randy Newman song.
Oh yeah.
When She Loved Me. And in fact, you sang it as an encore. I came to your cabaret at the Matcham Room. You sang it as an encore. I was really getting agitated because he's not going to sing it.
Yeah. It's been a really nice experience. I mean, I wanted to do something different. I was approached by a couple of companies to do a record, and was I going to do musical theatre? And I thought, well, no, everyone does that, really. And I just feel like, it's a bit like recording opera. Sometimes it doesn't really work out of context. And I didn't want to be recording, like the 27th recording of Being Alive and Maria and all this sort of stuff, which I love singing, but I just thought, I wanted to do something different. And I had a really fun time doing it and exploring different parts of my voice and different styles. It was a real challenge, but fun, a little taste of the crazy world of the music business.
Is there more to come? Is it a 2-record deal or a...
Just sort of in the middle of kind of debating what's going to happen next.
What's going to happen with Finding Neverland? I mean, is it a certain transfer? It must be. Surely it must be.
I hope so. I mean, it's difficult to say. I think it's just finding the right theatre, I think, at the moment.
I'm hearing the Savoy.
So I hear, but we've got the Savoy markings on our backstage where the Savoy stops. So I'm always standing in the bits that are not Savoy. Outside, presumably, in the, Strand. I do quick changes.
Where the traffic goes the wrong way down. Look, I'm gonna let you go, Julian, because you've got another interview and you've got a show to do, and I want it to be the best it can be.
I'll do my best for you.
Thanks.
All right.